Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is the second hour of the program. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about American politics, and our guest for the program is Samuel Popkin. He is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He has been following American presidential politics for some time. He served as a consultant to a number of campaigns, those of Jimmy Carter, McGovern, the 92 Clinton campaign, and the Gore campaigns. He's advised them on polling and strategy. He also has served as consultant to political parties in Canada and Europe and to the Departments of State and Defense. He's authored a number of books, and we'll be talking some about what you will find in his most recent. The title of the book is The Candidate. The subtitle is What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. It's published by the Oxford University Press. It's out now. Also, we're going to do something this morning a little unusual. We've had some big political news out of Washington this morning, as I'm sure you know. The Supreme Court largely let stand the president's health care overhaul. We're expecting that he will have some remarks, and we'll bring them to you. At least we'll listen to the president for a little while. We think maybe at about 11:15 that will happen. Our guest, Professor Popkin, will listen along with us, and then perhaps he can react to that, and we'll talk about some of the ideas that you will find in his book. Also, questions are welcome, as always, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And Professor Popkin, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Who knew what an amazing morning it would be?
Well, this is one of those days that people who love politics live for, when you have an enormous story here with very important implications. And of course, it will take us some time to digest just what the implications are.
And imagine what it's like for the campaigns when they have to guess not what the instant reaction will be, but what the reaction will be in a month, so they don't walk the wrong cliff or turn into the flamer of the moment.
Sure. Well, this here, the obvious question here, well, an obvious question is, while this has to be considered to be at this moment, a victory for the Obama administration, what sort of implication do you think this has for his reelection bid?
Well, I think the single most important one is that it now puts the repeal or not on the table. Just today, Mitch McConnell and Congressman Eric Cantor have said they're going to vote to repeal immediately. This, for the first time, gives President Obama a chance to show that he's a moderate by choice, not by weakness. The first time he has to veto something and show that he does have a stand that he's taking. You know, there's an old line of Henry Kissinger's, moderation is a virtue only when you have an alternative. And the senator who came to Washington saying he was going to bring everybody together and always find a happy median took a long time to adjust to the bitter realities. And now he has the chance to be the last defense of people with pre-existing conditions and defend a system that is slightly better to many with this law in place.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the big questions that I have in my mind, and you deal with in the book, is this question that when an individual goes into the voting booth and they're going to cast their vote, are they voting for an agenda or are they voting for a person? And it seems that while people like us like to talk about agendas, in fact, really, people are indeed voting for a person.
Well, one of the things I discovered in writing this, both with the voters and, in fact, the difference between the key part of the book is the subtitle where it says what it takes to win dash and hold dash the White House. Mm. They're very different. Mm. You campaign as the challenger, just as you said. You can trust my character and my resume and my reputation to project ahead what I will do. You can have faith in me because of what I have done, and I'll continue to be the knight in shining armor, the can-do person. If you're the incumbent, you've by definition, you overpromised on the way to the White House because everybody overpromises. And so now it's a matter of, okay, the glass is only half full. Without me, it might be empty. And look what you could lose if I'm defeated. Hmm. And every president who's had a divided government has made their name by fighting the extremes of the other party in the White House and letting people think about the overreaction that would come along with the other party. And now you've got Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan and the Tea Party demanding a very strong action and giving the president a chance to be the balanced middle, like Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton, dealing with a divided government. Mm.
You know, I think it's interesting, one of the points you make, and it's once you see it, it seems obvious, but you might not think about it that way beforehand, is that really you're talking about you're going to wage a different kind of campaign depending upon who you are, whether you are an incumbent, whether you are a challenger, or whether you are perhaps, let us say, the vice president.
I was shocked by how different they are. And it sort of said, like, how did I not notice this? How did we all not notice this? You're in the White House, you say, can we do again what we did in 92? Can we do again what we did in 76? And the president remembers all that and wants to fall back on it. And you realize, you can't do that again. You were on offense, now you're on defense. You're defending the White House. You know, it's King of the Hill. Come and get me. And it's what people will lose, not what you're going to promise. Because you can't, you're more of the same, in James Carville's famous phrase, not change or hope.
Well, this, though, I think is really interesting, and it's something that almost seems to surprise incumbents, because they often come to their reelection, it seems, with this attitude that says, I'm the president. Why should I have to justify my reelection? I'm the president. Yes. Isn't that obvious you should vote for me again? Because I'm the president.
In 1980, I was the person who played Ronald Reagan in the mock debates for President Carter at Camp David. Hmm. And I was very disconcerted and thrown for a loop by how shocked the president seemed to be when I merely quoted the very paragraphs Ronald Reagan, Governor Reagan, was using every day. And since then, I've realized every incumbent is a little bit the emperor's new clothes. They're so surrounded by business, and they're so isolated that they think they're in touch with the country, and they're not. And, you know, you get to the White House, and you think you're ready on day one to run everything. And then you get there, and the job is so much bigger than you imagined. You're overwhelmed. Your allies aren't as much allies as they said they were, and your enemies aren't nearly as willing to compromise as they said. And after 3 years, you finally understand, you know, how to make the place work. And you can't believe anybody would believe a challenger who acts like they're ready. And so when the challenger says exactly the same things about what they're going to do on day one that you said, you think they're idiots, and you can't believe you don't think the people have the right to believe that nonsense, even though they believed it when you said it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Professor Popkin, the president has begun to speak,
so we'll listen to
what he has to say.
There will be a lot of discussion today about the politics of all this, about who won and who lost. That's how these things tend to be viewed here in Washington. But that discussion completely misses the point. Whatever the politics, today's decision was a victory for people all over this country whose lives will be more secure because of this law and the Supreme Court's decision to uphold it. And because this law has a direct impact on so many Americans, I want to take this opportunity to talk about exactly what it means for you. First, if you're one of the more than 250 million Americans who already have health insurance, you will keep your health insurance. This law will only make it more secure and more affordable. Insurance companies can no longer impose lifetime limits on the amount of care you receive. They can no longer discriminate against children with pre-existing conditions. They can no longer drop your coverage if you get sick. They can no longer jack up your premiums without reason. They are required to provide free preventive care like checkups and mammograms, a provision that's already helped 54 million Americans with private insurance. And by this August, nearly 13 million of you will receive a rebate from your insurance company because it spent too much on things like administrative costs and CEO bonuses and not enough on your health care. There's more. Because of the Affordable Care Act, young adults under the age of 26 are able to stay on their parents' health care plans, a provision that's already helped 6 million young Americans. And because of the Affordable Care Act, seniors receive a discount on their prescription drugs, a discount that's already saved more than 5 million seniors on Medicare about $600 each. All of this is happening because of the Affordable Care Act. These provisions provide common sense protections for middle-class families, and they enjoy broad popular support. And thanks to today's decision, all of these benefits and protections will continue for Americans who already have health insurance. Now, if you're one of the 30 million Americans who don't yet have health insurance, starting in 2014, this law will offer you an array of quality, affordable private health insurance plans to choose from. Each state will take the lead in designing their own menu of options. And if states can come up with even better ways of covering more people at the same quality and cost, this law allows them to do that too. And I've asked Congress to help speed up that process and give states this flexibility in year one. Once states set up these health insurance marketplaces, known as exchanges, insurance companies will no longer be able to discriminate against any American with a pre-existing health condition. They won't be able to charge you more just because you're a woman. They won't be able to bill you into bankruptcy. If you're sick, you'll finally have the same chance to get quality, affordable health care as everyone else. And if you can't afford the premiums, you'll receive a credit that helps pay for it. Today, the Supreme Court also upheld the principle that people who can afford health insurance should take the responsibility to buy health insurance. This is important for two reasons. First, when uninsured people who can afford coverage get sick and show up at the emergency room for care, the rest of us end up paying for their care in the form of higher premiums. And second, if you ask insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions but don't require people who can afford it to buy their own insurance, some folks might wait until they're sick to buy the care they need, which would also drive up everybody else's premiums. That's why, even though I knew it wouldn't be politically popular and resisted the idea when I ran for this office, we ultimately included a provision in the Affordable Care Act that people who can afford to buy health insurance should take the responsibility to do so. In fact, this idea has enjoyed support from members of both parties, including the current Republican nominee for president. Still, I know the debate over this law has been divisive. I respect the very real concerns that millions of Americans have shared. And I know a lot of coverage through this health care debate has focused on what it means politically. Well, it should be pretty clear by now that I didn't do this because it was good politics. I did it because I believed it was good for the country. I did it because I believed it was good for the American people. You know, there's a framed letter that hangs in my office right now. It was sent to me during the health care debate by a woman named Natoma Canfield. For years and years, Natoma did everything right. She bought health insurance, she paid her premiums on time. But 18 years ago, Natoma was diagnosed with cancer. And even though she'd been cancer-free for more than a decade, her insurance company kept jacking up her rates year after year. And despite her desire to keep her coverage, despite her fears that she would get sick again, she had to surrender her health insurance and was forced to hang her fortunes on chance. I carried Natoma's story with me every day of the fight to pass this law. It reminded me of all the Americans all across the country who have had to worry not only about getting sick, but about the cost of getting well. Natoma is well today, and because of this law, there are other Americans, other sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers, who will not have to hang their fortunes on chance. These are the Americans for whom we passed this law. The highest court in the land has now spoken. We will continue to implement this law, and we'll work together to improve on it where we can. But what we won't do What the country can't afford to do is refight the political battles of 2 years ago or go back to the way things were. With today's announcement, it's time for us to move forward, to implement and, where necessary, improve on this law. And now's the time to keep our focus on the most urgent challenge of our time, putting people back to work, paying down our debt, and building an economy where people can have confidence that if they work hard, they can get ahead. But today, I'm as confident as ever that when we look back 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, we'll be better off because we had the courage to pass this law and keep moving forward. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless America.
You've been listening to President Obama. He was speaking from the White House about today's big news from Washington, and that was that the Supreme Court largely let stand his health care overhaul, something certainly would have to be considered to be a victory for the president and for the Democrats in Congress. And as the day goes on, we will have some analysis, I'm sure, from lawmakers in our area, people who are in the health industry, people who are advocates for healthcare consumers. Will have local reaction. There'll be lots of reaction from Washington as people try to digest and talk about what this ruling means. So we wanted to give you an opportunity to hear from the president right there. This is Focus, by the way. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. And I would like to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus, Samuel Popkin. He is professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, has written a lot about American politics, and is author of a new book, which is titled The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House, published by the Oxford University Press. Questions, as always, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, Professor Popkin, any particular reaction there to what the president had to say?
I have to wonder why he wasn't saying that once a month, at least for the last 3 years. That was, that speech just now sounded as if he'd had 48 hours to prepare it, to be frank. I expected more riffing here and there. What he'd laid out very carefully is what you lose if the law is repealed. He didn't say it that way. He said, we'll move beyond it. But he laid out very carefully what gets lost if the repeal goes through. And I think at this point, he's had the best 2 weeks of any bad economy incumbent in at least 50 years. Mm. And 2 weeks ago, I was asked, how is the president doing? And I said, he really doesn't have a campaign laid out yet. He hasn't put together pieces. And when you have a mixed, muddled economy like this, your campaign can make a big difference, your strategy. And starting with immigration and with today and with gay marriage, he has been splitting the Republican Party in ways that make it hard for them to do something that supports Governor Romney completely.
Another of the basic points I think you make in The Candidate, in addition to what we were talking about before about, you know, maybe what people do is they're voting for, they may not be voting for an agenda, maybe they're voting more for a person. But the individual candidate and how we respond to them, that's very important. But you also make the point that, you know, really the thing that's going to win it for you or lose it for you is your staff, the people that you pick to engineer your campaign.
Yes. Governor Romney is one of the most successful CEOs ever to run for president. I can't think of anybody who has been a more brilliant businessman. I mean, he was a stellar law student and MBA student. He was, like what he did or not, he was brilliant at doing it at Bain Capital. And after 2008, he said to his friend, you know, being a candidate is a lot harder than being a CEO. There's so many more things you have to do. And he saw how much more he has to delegate when he's out there acting like part of a royal family and can't be in the room. And he saw how critical it is, the timing. It won't hurt in the long run, but he stubbed his toe in a way that could have been serious on the Chinese dissident affair with Chen Guangfeng, and now he's tied very much to the Tea Party in ways he may or may not regret later. It's very hard to maneuver when you're a candidate and to keep on the right course.
Yeah. We have a caller, and I certainly would invite other people. If you have questions, comments, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Piatone for our first on line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting morning. I'm still trying to figure it out, but...
So are all the rest of us.
Yeah, it's going to be a while, I think. But personally, just my own personal opinion, and just from what I know people around me have said, is it's kind of like the majority doesn't win it. And I don't know if you know.
You're kind of breaking up on us. We lost your. I think we kind of lost the essence of your comment. You said the majority doesn't win.
Yeah, the majority. From all the things that have been said out there, all the facts and figures, it says the majority of the people in this country don't want that. They want something different. They don't. They want health care, but they want it in such a way that they're not being told you have to do this. And I understand the plight because I know a lot of people who don't have it and they can't afford it, but. The majority of the people run the country, not the minority. Unfortunately, it's not the way it's been going with it under the Democratic rule. They want everybody to have everything government all the time, everything government all the time with everything. And we're all going to be paying for somebody else's stuff. I mean, we're already paying right now with the crisis, at least in the state, about somebody else's retirement because we got the bulk of the baby boomers retiring all at once. So we're paying for somebody else's retirement, not your own. Now we're going to be paying for somebody else's health care, not your own. The thing that I'm afraid of is that we're not going to have the choice in doctors. I just got a new dentist and a new doctor. Does that mean now I'm going to have to go with what they say and what they want me to do? And, you know, I'm really afraid in my, and plus I have my own company, and now I'm going to have to tell my employees they're going to have to, I'm not going to pay for it, I'm quite frankly. And in my company, I will not pay for somebody else's stuff. Anymore. They're going to have to do it themselves. So, I mean, well, I think you're going to see the reaction from the country leaning that way.
I appreciate your comments. I wanted to go back to Professor Popkin. I guess the thing that strikes me and what I've read about this is that people seem to be of two minds about it. On the one hand, as the caller suggests, they don't like the idea of the mandate. But on the other hand, there are some features of the health care overhaul that they do like. And those were the things that the president led with when he just in the comments we just heard.
What's interesting about our caller's comment was that it reflects all the contradictory passions of people who have to supply health care for others. The one most interesting thing to me that is a common belief in this country is that we're not, what he said is, I don't want to have to pay for somebody else's health care. That's what we're doing already because our premiums are covering emergency rooms. And that's, we already are paying for everybody because you get an abscess, you wait till your leg is affected, you go to the emergency room. And like it or not, I think this is going to play out very differently than anybody on the left or right thinks. People forget that when Social Security was put in some states, there were violent reactions with snipers. They thought Social Security was even more of a communist socialist takeover than the health care mandate. And try and end Social Security today, and those same people would get their guns out again.
Well, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to be a part of the conversation here again, we're talking with Samuel Popkin. His new book is The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Well, recently I've had two conversations with two different guests about American politics. Just this week I talked with Jonathan Haidt. He's authored this new book. It's titled The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And then last week I talked with E.J. Dionne, And what was striking, I think, about both of those things were both of those conversations were how it is in America we really do agree on a certain set of core principles. The problem is that we don't give them equal weight. And that's the thing that, you know, it's not that we disagree on what's important. It's just that we disagree on what's most important.
We wouldn't need priests if the Ten Commandments, you know, were adequate all by themselves. And, you know, I'd like to point out to people, even in the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments were followed up with another 600 plus commandments. When you apply principles, you always have values and conflict. And you can always disagree. Our caller talked about the people who already believe they have obligations coming to them with pensions, the young people who expect to have future obligations. Do you worry about the children or the elderly? Do you worry about the insured or the uninsured? There is never an easy resolution of these conflicts.
In this hour of focus, we're talking with Samuel Popkin. He's professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and we'll talk some more with him in just a moment after a very short break. This is Focus.
Chef Marcus Samuelson was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, and now runs one of New York's most celebrated restaurants in Harlem. On the next Fresh Air, he talks about the insults and abuse he faced training in some of Europe's elite restaurants and why it made him a better chef. Marcus Samuelson's new memoir is called Yes, Chef. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Tomorrow morning on the program in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about someone who has contributed very importantly to the built environment in Urbana, this community where we are. Although people might not know his name, we'll be talking about the architect Joseph Royer. He was active in this community for about 50 years, beginning shortly after the time he graduated from the university, which was 1895, and he designed many of the important buildings in Urbana. We'll be talking with Brian Adams, who's authored a book about Royer and his work. And then we'll finish up with May Barenbaum, one of our favorite guests. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I and occasionally is on the show, and we talk about insects, not so much how to exterminate them, but we try to appreciate them for all their fascinating ways that they live their lives. That's tomorrow. A lot of past programs on the web archive. You can listen anytime you like. It's at WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Samuel Popkin. He's a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He has served as a consultant to a number of campaigns on polling and strategy, and also has served as consultant to political parties in Canada and Europe and to the Departments of State and Defense. His new book is The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Oxford University Press is the publisher, and among other things, he makes the observation that, in fact, depending on who you are, whether you are a challenger or incumbent, it means running a very different kind of campaign. We have another caller here, someone to talk with in Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just had a comment about the events of the morning.
Sure.
And what I heard Romney say as a response, he said that on his very first day, if elected, he would strike down the health care plan. But I have not heard from Romney or his cohorts a replacement. And to strike down something that covers everybody without a similar replacement, I find disingenuous. So I'll ring off and listen online.
All right. And Professor Popkin, I think that indeed has all been the case all along, where the Republicans in Congress essentially said the same thing.
Let me make a point that I realized in studying this year in the context of looking in my book at the campaign since 1948. Mm-hmm. I realized that President Obama, President Clinton, and President Reagan were very lucky in the primaries that their big challengers were to the center side of them. So they didn't have to move that far to the right or left. And the same with George W. Bush. They didn't have to move that far to the right or left to get the nomination. Governor Romney's challengers were all on the right and financed big time by super PAC money. And he had to make compromises. Now, in 2009, he wrote an op-ed in USA Today saying if the president would drop the public option, he'd have the ideal health care plan, just like Massachusetts. Now he has to repudiate it and say he'll repeal it, and he's in a very difficult position about the pre-existing conditions, et cetera. He's in a smoke and mirrors period, and when the Congress goes to repeal it, he's in a very difficult position between what's good for him and what's good for the reputations of the most radical part of his party. He's in a really difficult situation.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Effingham. This next caller here, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you. Try to keep it short. One question. Does your guest understand the difference between capitalism and imperial capitalism? Thank you.
I'm not quite sure what the caller was getting at.
Well, I think... Well, we could be talking about I assume he's talking about foreign policy and United Fruit and taking over other countries, but he might just be talking about the imperial presidency. In either way, the difference is in the eye of the beholder, and every candidate for president has to define their vision of what a president should be to appeal to some people who want more president and some who want less. But I do understand the difference.
I wanted to ask you about another key idea in the book, and it's you stated so nicely that I had to steal the line and use it for the promo that I wrote for the show. That is your comment here early on that in every presidential election campaign, there are two winners. There is the inevitable winner when it begins and the inevitable victor after it ends. And I would certainly add here, and that sometimes that might even be the same person, but not always.
And in fact,
here right in the prologue, a great example here is the very first line of your prologue to the book is this question: whatever happened to President Rudy Giuliani?
Exactly. This is where you see the importance of the work you have to do, both your homework and your intellectual work and your team building to make it through this public marathon. It is not true that campaigns are longer. It is true that the public part of the campaign is longer. And this long gauntlet you run weeds out a lot more people who are incompetent, ill-prepared, and unable to get close to the office than we realize. Mm-hmm. Think of the people who were blown away by their inability to know how far to promise or how far to go. Governor Perry, Congressman Bachman, Congressman Gingrich, clever lines that could raise a little money but not a real solid program. And now we see Mike Tyson's great line coming into play. Whenever he was asked about an opponent and how the opponent said, we got a strategy to deal with Tyson, Tyson would say, they all have a strategy till I hit him in the face. And that's when, on a day like this, let's see what happens, how quickly Governor Romney comes to details that he's going to need. Let's see what happens if Senator McConnell and Congressmen Cantor and Ryan go further to satisfy their constituents and their reputation than is good for the Romney campaign. Now, we have some real conflicts coming up, and we're going to see how well negotiated they're going to be by Governor Romney. He has to worry about what his Congress party does, not just what his campaign does.
So you seem to be saying, I think that there are a lot of people who are very unhappy with this process that we have for selecting candidates, and they say that it is too long, and that it gets weighed down by trivialities, that we somehow don't really manage to talk about the things that really matter. It sounds to me as if you're saying, actually, this system that we have works pretty well in selecting the best candidate.
It
Do you
works
think that's true?
Better than the smoke-filled rooms work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it works better than in parliamentary systems where you run the speaker against the minority leader. I mean, you could have had a system where you run the speaker of the House against the minority leader, or you run the Senate majority leader against the Senate minority leader. That would be a system. You wouldn't have the exciting, heroic outsiders rushing in. You'd get the legislative parties. But that is the only way I can think of to shorten the system and not have incompetent flakes.
Well, our guest in this hour of focus is Samuel Popkin. I want to introduce him again in case you have just tuned in. He is professor of political science at University of California, San Diego. He has authored a number of books about American politics. His most recent is entitled The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. It's published by the Oxford University Press. We have about 12 or 13 minutes left in this part of the show. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We also have email, if you want to send us an email, and that is will-talk@illinois.edu. I don't know if there are particular of recent campaigns, particular failed campaigns, where you would say there are particularly important lessons to be learned. If I indeed ask that question, are there some?
Well, I think so. I think if you looked at the Carter campaign of 80 or the Gore campaign or the Dole campaign, you see where very poor decisions were made. And maybe the one that you could learn the most lessons from would be President Bush in 1992, mm-hmm. where he deferred too long on biting some bullets and thought he could then put it all together at the end. And that disastrous Japan trip of his, it wasn't disastrous because of the famous vomit. It was disastrous because a trip designed to show how foreign policy brought us jobs showed how unprepared he was, in fact, to deal with economic issues overseas as opposed to war and peace issues. And I think you can learn a lot when you realize how long it takes to put the pieces together and how much work you have to do.
We have some other callers. We have several, in fact. Let's talk next with someone in Charleston. This would be line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank you. My question is there any body or institution that's collecting data on the amount of money spent in these elections? I mean, you said they've not gotten longer, but certainly it seems like they've gotten more expensive.
That's for
My
sure.
concern is that we're actually spending more money on electing somebody than those elected officials are spending on the populace which they serve.
Well, there are several sources. I can't cite the websites off the top of my head, but there are a number of places from the FEC and elsewhere where you get the money from the last elections. And it is it's as much as Windows will spend on selling Windows 8 or Apple will spend on sending a new product. It is a lot of money. I think the problem is that it's like an arms race. If we and the Russians had ended the Cold War with a quarter as many weapons each, it would have been the same. But how do you stop one side from enlarging the arsenal without stopping the other side? And in the campaign, everybody wants to match the opponent, and you get this race. And this time, we're going to see a very different competition. The Obama campaign is investing in get out the vote, and the Romney campaign, well, not the campaign, the Romney side in this case, has a huge amount of independent money in the super PACs that will be doing advertising. And we'll see whether 1,000 ads are as good as our drive to the polls or not.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah, sure.
Is there anything in this, anything undemocratic about the spirit of the willingness of these wealthy donors to give millions of dollars to benefit their own self-interest and not be willing to give taxes to help lessen the burden of their, peers in society?
The answer to that question tells me whether when you answer that question, I'll know whether you're a liberal or a conservative.
And you would not want to answer the question for yourself?
No, for myself, I prefer a system where the money is both transparent and goes to the candidates or the parties. What I don't like is a million people running as their own little organizations. And what I don't like is the Buckley Supreme Court decision that says you can spend unlimited amounts of your own money. Because if Mitt Romney can spend his $200 million, if we cut off all the other money, then nobody can run against Mitt Romney without $200 million. Mm-hmm. And so if the Supreme Court said you can limit what an individual can spend on themselves, then we could have a system of controlled finances. Without that, we're stuck with what we have.
And that's the famous Buckley decision. It was the decision where the court said essentially money is speech, and you can't curb someone's right to speech, so you can't curb someone's right to spend their
his own
money.
That everybody can spend, corporations can spend.
Yeah, and that I don't think that that's likely to change, or I don't think that the
I
court's
think not.
Likely to change.
And I think the conservatives who thought it was a godsend for them may realize there's truth to the old adage, be careful what you wish for because you might get it. Look at the damage the huge spending has done to Governor Romney during the primaries. Look at the money that one super donor gave Governor Santorum that pushed Governor Romney to condemn contraception. Look at the money that went to Newt Gingrich to publicize what Newt Gingrich called the sins of Bain Capital. Look at the money that went to Rick Perry to attack immigration. There are the people who have the big super PAC money have their own agendas, and they're not necessarily good for the party or the candidate. Hmm.
We have 7-8 minutes left here. We have some other callers. We'll try to get as many as we can, and we will go next to somebody in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Again, on the health care decision this morning, ever since it was released, the media have been saying that it was a victory for the liberals. Now, this might be a really stupid, naive question, but isn't the Supreme Court supposed to look solely at the constitutionality of something when deciding cases? And so if they decided that the healthcare law was constitutional, then everyone is distorting what they did. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it makes sense. And everybody immediately wants to know whose side, for or against it, was a victory. And I'm sure the same things were said when Brown v. the Board of Education was decided, or when Citizens United, they're just telling you whose interpretation of the law was closer to the Supreme's version of the law. And so you're right, but that's just the way we want to know who wins and loses on the Constitution this time.
Makes good sense. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well,
let me make a comment about
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
I think 20 years ago when people, very educated conservatives or very educated liberals, would talk to their campaigners for their candidates and say, remind people about the Supreme Court. You're going to have two appointments. Remind people. Well, very few people who didn't already care about that would have understood it, because it was a complicated, if somebody retires, then you'll make the appointment and that could change the law. That's very complicated if you don't already understand it. Now, between immigration and health care, I think for the first time, since possibly with desegregation, in a long time, you really could have people thinking about who's going to appoint the court in the next election.
And you can think for both campaigns, that will be a helpful argument for them to try to remind voters that
try to muster, and they'll have to decide where to make it and to whom. I don't think there's an argument about the court that you can necessarily make the same everywhere to get the full benefit. Notice when the president spoke on gay marriage, the Republican Party was silent and divided, and you only had people in a few states either cheering or booing, and most people weren't sure how to figure out what it meant. And Governor Romney said very little about it because it's such a complicated issue now.
All right, let's go to Bloomington, Illinois for another caller here, line two. Hello.
Hi, I wanted to call because the first caller, he may talk to a lot of people, but I've answered over, literally thousands of calls on a hotline. And there are so many people who can't get help, who can't get their health care, especially like single people who have developed health problems, say in their 40s or 50s. And this is going to help millions. This law is going to help literally millions of people because they need this help. And I can't see that it's not going to benefit the majority, because as long as we have people who can get health care, hopefully they'll get better sooner and be back to being productive rather than being on some kind of welfare.
Let me comment on this probably correct factual point about the future. People don't vote on their welfare. They vote on what their opinions about their welfare. This election is not going to be decided on the ultimate value of health care. This election is not going to be decided on the ultimate value of the Arizona immigration law. It's not going to be decided on the ultimate value of gay marriage. It's going to be decided on people's opinions about those issues. And we don't know whether the people who see the benefit are more passionate about the benefits they have won and could lose, or the people who fear the losses will be more passionate about those. That's where we're going to see the maneuvering of the two campaigns to either scare people about what they might lose on the Obama side or scare people about what might happen to them on the Romney side. Both sides have to figure out how to make their case clearer.
We will try to get, I want to thank the caller, we'll try to get one more, line three in Champaign. We'll have to be quick, but please go ahead.
Hi. I just have a comment about getting people to the polls to vote. In Illinois, our votes don't count because we know Illinois is going to go for the Democrats. We know it's going to go for Obama. If I lived in Ohio or Florida, my vote would count because of the Electoral College and the way that we elect presidents here, it's not by the popular vote, it is by the Electoral College. And so we really are disenfranchised in states where they know which way we're going to go ahead of time. It's the borderline states that they don't know which way they're going to go. Those are the states where your vote actually will count. So I really think we need to change the way we elect our presidents with the Electoral College, get rid of it, do it by a popular vote, straight up and down. That seems to me then everybody's vote does count. And that's just my comment, if you will.
Professor, this is something that seems to come around every 4 years, and then we forget about it.
All I can say is amen. But the changes in the we have a federal system. I would settle for a uniform national ballot as a start, or a uniform national identity card that allowed you to vote once, whatever state you were in on election day. But those would require already a constitutional revolution. And it's not true your vote doesn't count, because in Illinois you still decide how many congressmen there are going to be in each party. And don't think that's trivial. Let's not add to the fantasy that the president is a monarch who does what he wants, the president is the difference between a bill passing with 67 senators when he's against it or 50 senators when he's for it. Hmm. And that's not trivial, but it's not the whole game.
We're just about the point where we got to finish. We have about a minute or so left. There's so many things we could talk about. I guess, again, I'm back to the mechanics of the campaign and the idea that you run, you think you know what your arguments are going to be, you think you know what the issues are, but you never know what is going to happen. How does a campaign be prepared for anything to happen?
You think, as a football fan, let me make a Bears or a Packers or a Vikings analogy from my home areas. When the quarterback is in the huddle, there's 15 seconds for the person on the sideline to communicate the next play. When you're the candidate, you don't have time to talk to 30 people about this healthcare decision for 20 minutes each. You need somebody who can tell you what the gang thinks that you've talked with enough times, so in an hour in between speeches and fundraisers and votes and et cetera, you can absorb and make the final decisions or send them back for a little bit more work. And that's what we're going to see in the next days. How well prepared was the Obama White House? How well prepared was the Romney campaign for the contingencies of the next few weeks when somebody in Congress is going to make an outrageous claim? They're going to have to say something. Some governors or senators are going to say things. And in the middle of this, Governor Romney has to decide who is the ideal vice president. How do you decide that without knowing where you stand? How do you decide on who your vice president should be before you've decided exactly what your alternative to health care is going to be, so you get somebody who can be on your page?
A lot to think about here. Will, I'm sorry to say, have to stop at that point. You want to read more, you should look for the book we've talked about, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House, by our guest, Samuel Popkin. He is professor of political science at University of California, San Diego. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.